Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today is February 3rd, and I want to start this meeting at 1:36. Apologize for the delay today. They were having a majority press hearing in here, and so we were all waiting in the hallway. So thank you for everybody for your patience. And I want to also apologize that we were supposed to be talking about the disaster declarations, extensions, and the liability of what happened, who's responsible for what, you know, if things with the mandates go wrong. However, the bottom line is that due to circumstances with the administration and the changes, as you guys know, with the Attorney General, we are delaying that at this point in time. And people that were invited to talk about the impacts to education and the elderly are going to be testifying today after we hear Senate Bill 14, which is on the agenda today. So we're just asking for grace with everybody just because there's unexpected things that happened this week that have caused us to change. We also had a very late floor session today, and so we've been scrambling to get here. So thank you for everyone's grace and patience. With us today, we have Vice Chairman Senator Schauer. We have Senator Keel, Senator Hughes, and Senator Myers. And we have Alex as the IT. Thank you very much for being here. And Nancy, of course, you're wonderful. And I've never gotten minutes faster, ever, than I got from this meeting last time. So thank you for your exceptional work. We really do appreciate it a lot. Kelly Toth is my aide today. And as you guys know, Chair Reinbold. So we are going to go ahead and start with a bang today. We are going to start with the Judiciary Committee. It was the only bill that had been referred and actually requested a meeting. So we're going to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 14. And Mr. Vice Chairman, how would you like to proceed?
I would like to take the table with the, and I'll have a staff online.
Okay.
That will be calling as well.
Okay. Outstanding. So you're gonna go
That's
down
right.
there? Okay. Oh, Senator Holland, I am so sorry. And Representative Josephson, thank you so much. I don't have a script today, so I'm being a little bit flexible. So thank you guys for your grace today. All right, we've had to modify quite a few things today. Welcome, Mr. Vice Chairman. If you could please start your presentation in regards to Senate Bill 14.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Senator Schauer, for the record, and I will have online and should be available, I would like to get a comm check, make sure he's there, is my senior policy advisor and staffer, Scott Ogan.
Scott, do you want to go ahead and put your name on? And you guys are definitely going to, because there's two male, you're definitely going to have to say who's speaking when. So Scott, can you just say hello to the committee? And
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Ogan. I'm the senior policy advisor to Senator Mike Schauer.
Excellent. You're loud and clear. With that, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. And so, ladies and gentlemen of the committee and to the public, this is about SB, Senate Bill 14. This is our sponsor statement. I'll walk us through that, and then I'll have Mr. Ogan walk us through the sectional analysis. So, Senate Bill 14. It is an act relating to the selection and retention of judicial officers for the Court of Appeals and the District Court and of magistrates, relating to the duties of the Judicial Council, relating to the duties of the Commission on Judicial Conduct, and relating to the retention or rejection of a judicial officer. Alaska's Constitution is clear. Superior Court judges and Supreme Court justices must be vetted by the Judicial Council, and the Governor can only select from a list of two or more submitted by the Judicial Council. However, the Constitution also leaves the door open for legislative discretion with jurisdictional issues with how appellate court and magistrates are selected and how all judges are screened. Currently, the Judicial Council prescribes 100% of the screening criteria. One section of this bill gives direction to the Judicial Council on that particular subject. Currently, magistrates serve at the discretion of the Chief Justice, and appellate court judges are nominated in a statute-defined process, which mirrors the constitutional Judicial Council process. The Judicial Council is structured to give a permanent majority of bar members the control of who gets to be a judge or justice. Additionally, judges' names are subject to a bar member-controlled pre-screening process. Bar members are appointed internally by the bar with no legislative or administrative oversight. Non-bar members, those three members from the public, are in a minority position to influence final decisions. In essence, Madam Chair, what it ends up being is a 4-3. If you were to have a tie-breaking vote between the three lawyers and the three non or the public members, the Supreme Court Chief Justice would be the tie-breaking vote, so four lawyers versus three civilians. Senate Bill 14 attempts to strike more of a balanced approach by letting the governor and the people have a small say in who sits in judgment on the bench when they appear before them. It allows the governor to appoint and the legislature to confirm who fills magistrates and appellate judges. It still allows the judicial council to recommend candidates, but the governor does not necessarily have to appoint them. The governor can appoint his own appellate judges. This bill also takes the judicial retention rating process from the judicial council, importantly, and gives it to the Commission on Judicial Conduct. As the judicial council ratings tend to be non-critical, the CJC receives complaints about judges, and quite honestly, they are in the best position to make those assessments. With judicial elections deemed nonpartisan, virtually no political effort or mechanism to mount such an effort is ever directed towards educating the public about judges and their record for the retention process, because we don't elect our judges in Alaska, we simply retain them after they're appointed. A conflict of interest may arise with evaluating attorneys, because when lawyers in the council rate a judge with a critical rating, will that lawyer ever get a fair hearing before that judge? Memories can be long. It's something that may very well be in the back of the mind of somebody who's making that decision. The sponsor respectfully suggests that lawyers may have a conflict of interest when they rate judges for retention. The sponsor also very respectfully suggests that a better group to write reviews of judges' performance would be the Commission on Judicial Conduct. They are the people that field complaints about judges. With the recent rulings affecting political cases which ignore or nullify the clear legislative intent, which is one of the things we've been looking at, is the separation of powers between the branches, there is little doubt the justice process can be politicized and should have some balance, some modicum of balance between the representatives and governors that are elected by the people, the branch of 60 as opposed to perhaps just one. Madam Chair, that is our sponsor statement. I'd like to turn it over after questions for Mr. Ogun to go through the sectional analysis.
And we're going to take just a tiny, tiny brief at ease, okay?
You bet.
And Mr. Vice Chairman, I'm having a little bit of a hard time, the muffling, and we're going to keep our 6 feet, or distance, roughly, if people are comfortable, but I'm going to allow for the removal of the mask so I can hear you, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will do that for this purpose. Well, I can do that. I'll lean forward. It's fine. My question would be then, is there any portion of what I gave for the sponsor statement that you would like to be repeated for the record or for the committee? Okay. Very well.
Okay. Please proceed.
Okay, so that is the sponsor statement, Madam Chair. I'll take questions at this time if there are any. Otherwise, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Ogun to take us through the sectional analysis.
Please proceed.
Mr. Ogun, when you're ready.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Section 1 amends 15-03010 by adding magistrates to the nonpartisan ballot designed for each judicial district in which the justice, judge, or magistrate is seeking retention. Section 2 amends 15-35100 by making magistrates subject to retention election. Section 3 amends AS 15-35110 by requiring a magistrate seeking retention to file a declaration of candidacy for retention. Section 4 amends AS 15-35120 by requiring a magistrate seeking retention to pay a $30 filing fee. Section 5 amends 15-35130 by requiring the Director of Elections to place the name of the magistrate who has properly filed a declaration of candidacy on the ballot in the judicial district designated in the declaration of candidacy. Section 6 amends AS 15-35135 by permitting a magistrate to withdraw from candidacy for retention in writing unless the notice of withdrawal is received less than 64 days before the date of the election. Section 7 amends AS 15-58050 by requiring the Commission on Judicial Conduct rather than the Judicial Council file a statement with the Lieutenant Governor that includes information about each Supreme Court Justice, Court of Appeals Judge, Superior Court Judge, District Court Judge, and Magistrate who will be subject to a retention election. Section 8 amends AS 15-58-060-alpha by requiring magistrate judges seeking retention to pay $150 fee to the lieutenant governor at the time of the filing under AS 15-58. Section 9 and 10, excuse me, amends AS 15-58-060-Charlie and AS 22-05-100 by replacing judicial counsel with Commission on Judicial Conduct. Section 11 amends AS 22-07-060 by authorizing the Commission on Judicial Conduct rather than the judicial counsel to conduct an evaluation and provide information and a recommendation regarding a court of appeals judge subject to retention election. Adds magistrates to the position a judge may not be appointed to for 4 years following rejection of the judge's candidacy. Section 12 amends AS 22-07-070-Bravo by allowing the judicial counsel to submit the names of a judicial candidate to the governor for consideration for court appeals only if the counsel determines that the candidate understands and is committed to strict and constitutional interpretation of statutes and regulations in adhering to legislative intent. Amends AS 22-07-070-alpha by allowing the governor to appoint a person who is not nominated by the council but is qualified under AS 22-07-040, requiring confirmation by a majority of members of the legislature meeting in joint session and making an appointment effective upon the latter of either legislative confirmation or actual vacancy. Section 13, excuse me, amends AS 22-10-150 by authorizing the Commission on Judicial Conduct rather than the Judicial Council to conduct an evaluation and provide information and a recommendation regarding a Superior Court judge subject to retention election. Section 14 amends AS 22-15-170-alpha by allowing the governor to appoint a person to a district court or magistrate vacancy who is not nominated by the Judicial Council but is qualified under AS 22-15-160, requiring confirmation by a majority of the members of the legislature meeting in joint session and making an appointment effective upon the latter of either legislative confirmation or actual vacancy. Section 15 amends 22-15-170-ECHO by allowing the Judicial Council to submit the name of the judicial candidate to the governor for the district court or magistrate position only if the council determines that the judicial candidate understands and is committed to strict constitutional interpretation of statutes and regulations and adhering to a legislative intent. Section 16 amends AS 22-15-195 by authorizing the Commission on Judicial Conduct rather than the Judicial Council to conduct an evaluation and provide information and a recommendation regarding district court and magistrate judges subject to retention election. Section 17 amends AS 22-15-205 to allow the impeachment of magistrates. Section 18 amends AS 22-30-011-alpha to allow an inquiry into the potential misconduct of the magistrate. Section 19 amends AS 22-30-011-bravo to allow the Commission on Judicial Conduct to exonerate or admonish a magistrate or recommend counseling and to hold disciplinary hearing to consider potential misconduct of a magistrate. Section 20 amends AS 22-30-011-Charlie to entitle a magistrate to counsel at a hearing before the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Section 21 amends AS 22-30-011-Delta to to allow for exoneration or discipline of a magistrate after a hearing described in AS 2230011 Bravo. Section 22 amends AS 2230011 Golf to allow an exonerated magistrate to request that the Commission on Judicial Conduct proceedings and report be made public. Section 23 amends 2230070 to provide for disqualification, suspension, removal, retirement, and censure of a magistrate. Section 24 amends AS 2235 by adding a new section prohibiting the use of state funds to support or oppose the retention or rejection of a judicial officer in an election under AS 15. This section does not apply to the duties of the Commission on Judicial Conduct under AS 15580050, AS 2205100, AS 2207060, AS 2210150, and AS 2215195. Lastly, but not leastly, Section 25 repeals AS 2215170C, 170D, and AS 2230011H. That concludes my sectional analysis.
Thank you. So, Mr. Vice Chairman, how would you like to proceed?
At this point, Madam Chair, we're happy to answer questions on the sponsor statement, the intent, or the sectional analysis itself. And then at the will of the committee, of course, take questions or requests for further information, expert testimony, et cetera, on the bill. I mean, obviously, we're not prepared to do that yet until we see what the will of the committee is and what they would like to know. But at this point, I would like to open it up as if it works for you. To start answering kind of the initial committee's questions on, you know, the intent and the issues of the bill itself.
Are there any questions at this time or comments? Representative Myers, or Senator Myers, I'm so sorry.
You never had to do that.
I'm so, so sorry. I could say Lieutenant Governor Myers.
We'll go with that. So my first question is, excuse me, through the chair to Senator Schauer, is on Section 25. I'm curious why we are repealing AS 22.30.011H. I, offhand, at first glance, I would think that we'd want to be keeping that because it creates the reports of judicial misconduct, and we want to keep that going.
And, Madam Chair, if it is okay, like many of us, legislators, we end up being a jack of all trades, master of none, because we're all running on too many levels. So the staff member that I directed to take the deep dive is Mr. Rogan, which is why he's here with us, and he has done most of the legislative research and the work with Ledge Legal to get us here to the bill. So I would like to defer. I will certainly answer any questions that I can, but from the technical aspect, I'm going to defer to him until we get further requests from the council, just so that I do not misinterpret why certain sections are related as they are for what needs to happen for the purposes of the bill, if that is acceptable to the committee.
Mr. Ogan, did you understand the question?
Madam Chair, I'm going to have to get back with you on that. This is one of the recommendations. I think it was, I interpreted it as being conforming by the drafter I'm at a somewhat of a handicap. I'm on day five of my exodus journey to the Capitol through various logistical and mechanical breakdowns and logistical issues trying to get down there. So I'm literally working from a hotel room, and I don't have all my reference material I normally have. I'm working on three different electronic venues, and I can't look up that statute. I don't have that one in front of me. So would it be possible to get back with you on that one?
Sounds like we're going to need to.
Okay. Sounds good. So we'll look forward to hearing back from you. My staff has taken down the information, and if you could get back to us in regards to that, that's a really important question. And it's, I think right now the best place to be is in neutral. There's just so many things that are changing and moving, not only in the administration but also in the Senate. So with thanks for being here actually today online, because we do appreciate your expertise. I believe Senator Hughes had a question. Is that correct?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Sauer, for bringing this bill forward. I know a lot of people in my district have concerns. And the argument's been made that this might politicize things, but I see things actually as somewhat quite politicized already. So I'll just say that for the record. But one of the things I'm wondering about is moving the duties from the council to the commission, so the judicial council to the conduct commission. And the conduct commission I'm seeing here is made up of three justices or judges, three attorneys, and three members of the public. So you basically have six attorneys and three public members. Do you know what the makeup of the judicial council is as far as attorneys versus public members?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, we do. The Judicial Council, and you may remember being Judiciary Chair 2 years ago, this is a little bit of deja vu, this is slightly different, but we had SJR 3 filed, which was a slight change to how the Judicial Council members, of which there are three members selected by the Alaska Bar Association, there are three civilians, non-lawyers, selected, so there are six members on the Judicial Council. The tie-breaking vote, and the one that runs the council in essence according to the rules, is the Supreme Court Chief Justice. So there are seven members that would be on it. And in case of a tie, then the Supreme Court Chief Justice would become the seventh member to break the tie vote. So that is how it is set up currently under the Judicial Council. As you have illuminated yourself, it is different for the commission.
A follow-up? And actually, it wasn't even deja vu all the way back to last year, because I think you said it in your opening remarks, and it was just like, hello. So now you're moving it to one where it's six attorneys and three public members. And so I'm curious about that. I'm also wondering, not knowing about enough about the commission, conduct commission, is whether they would have information on every single judge and every name that would come before them, because they're dealing with judges who've had complaints filed against them. So they might be, it might be difficult for them to provide information on someone. So I'm wondering if you would be open to some kind of combination of the duties, you know, where they'd be both the commission and the council, which would have the duty to provide and score, and would you be open to some combination?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I think we've got you covered. I'm going to have Mr. Ogun back me up to make sure I don't get the technical aspects of how they're connected wrong. However, the Judicial Council still provides information, so that's kind of covered, but like I said, I'm going to have him do the tie together for the nuance portion. So that's still happening with this. Remember that, and we'll cover this as well, that you go, well, there's nine now as opposed to, you know, six in essence. However, remember, we're no longer restricting and saying that you must pick from that, right? So this is what is different about this now, as opposed to saying that's all you get, and Governor, you don't have a choice to do anything else. This trade association is going to tell you who's going to sit on the bench. That's kind of how it works in a way, or could work, certainly the way it's structured, is now they're going to make those recommendations with the appropriate information, hopefully a better body that is looking at the record of the judges and not just from a pre-screened trade organization making those decisions. And so we have a little bit more, we hope, of balance, but still we're not constraining that they must be picked from that. And finally, and again, I'll have Mr. Ogun kind of comment to make sure that I'm getting the technical side of it correct, is that we always have the cross-check now. And that cross-check would be the legislature will have the ability to have that up or down vote. So we are, instead of having what is in essence a trade organization with no input from the people possible into selecting who sits on the courts, now we will have 60 members that are representatives of the people who have been elected who have a say in the process. And I agree with you to say it's not politicized. Well, no, we all know that's not true. The court itself has directed, for example, SJR 3 that you heard as the Judiciary Chair 2 years ago, to get involved in the process. So you can't say it's not politicized when the court itself is directing their court liaison to come in and be involved and try to kill a bill, you know, or in this case it was a constitutional amendment. It's absolutely political, and anybody that says otherwise is trying to sell you something. So I would tell you that I think we're trying to find a more elegant solution, one that does not take away the voice of the people, because remember right now, with essentially one-third of our government structure, the judiciary can be decided in essence by a trade organization. And if I was to say, well, the legislature should work in a manner that former legislators get together and they're able to choose who the next legislators are or who they can be and the people, you know, can vote on them, oh, people would be up in arms. We would never allow that. But that is, in fact, in essence, how the structure is set up constitutionally to choose our judges who sit on the bench. So we're trying to find something that might have more balance. It might have more input from the people ultimately through this, and allow that broader impact to it without being so constrained by such a small group to have that power. One final comment, not to that answer, but I should have, and Madam Chair, this is my fault. I should have mentioned that Mr. Ogun, he is on a bit of a journey. He was supposed to be here on Sunday. We should have been here prepped and ready to go, but his truck broke down in Tok. The Canadians weren't going to let him cross the border. And unfortunately, he's stuck in a hotel room with weather like this and can't get out on the ferry. So I apologize for that. He's doing his best from a hotel room without great connection and all of his resources. So we will get the answers to you, but right now we're a little bit constrained because he is my expert and can't get here. So that's Alaska for you in the wintertime trying to get to Juneau, which some people know. So I apologize. Hope, Madam Chair, that answers the question for Senator Hughes, but I would like Mr. Ogun to perhaps illuminate any areas I may have missed or get them correct.
Mr. Ogun?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Through the chair, yes. Senator Hughes, if you reflect back on the reviews, the judicial reviews, I don't recall ever seeing any judicial reviews that were really critical of any judges. It would be kind of like I think the Senator Schauer referenced, it would be like the legislature would write the reviews that go into the election pamphlet for those members in their party. I can guarantee you that almost none of them would do anything wrong or look bad. So we think it's a little bit of an inherent conflict, not that it's a nefarious one, just one of human nature. We think that maybe, and I'm not personally, I can't speak for the senator, but I'm open to personally considering maybe a balance, but the Commission on Judicial Conduct are the ones that get the complaints on judges, and they vet those complaints, and they determine if they're sufficient or not. And I think they're going to be looking at judges with a little bit less than rose-colored glasses and a little bit more objective recommendations for the public when they're considering their votes on judges. And I don't have an issue personally with having a hybrid of those two groups working together on it, because I know there's a process in place where they get input from all the different attorneys. I'm not sure if they get that input for the ratings. I know they certainly get it for who they submit as far as who's considered to be a judge. So, but we need to understand that we're not changing the structure of the way justices, Supreme Court justices are appointed, and Superior Court judges. That is going to remain constitutionally the same. Currently, the appellate court judges are appointed with the exact same process that we use for the rest of the judges, and that's driven by statute, and that's what we're changing here. And we're also throwing in magistrates as well.
Madam Chair, may I make one comment to that before the next question?
Senator Schauer?
Is we are, you know the way I operate, all options are on the table, right? I say this all the time. So if the committee or members of it have things that they want to entertain for amendments, I'm open to that. If you can help me find a way to make this better where it's more balanced, we will absolutely take that under advisement, and most likely would be happy to argue that and end up in the bill. So just to make it clear to the committee, this is not a, you know, the flag is planted in the ground and my way or the highway, and this is absolutely not. We're open to make it better. That's the hope. Thank you.
And I'd like to quickly point out also that we have Marla Greenstein from the Commission of Judicial Conduct and Suzanne DiPietro online at a future date. We're going to, and we and Nancy Mee, thank you as well. We will be discussing this with you later. But anyway, just wanted to point that out. Senator Hughes, were you finished?
Well, I had another question, but I can be in the queue.
Why don't we go to Senator Keel, and then we'll jump back to you, okay?
Okay.
All right. Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to hear from the court system's various folks at a later date. That'll be valuable. couple of different areas of inquiry. Let me start with this one. I guess, Madam Chair, the sponsor's staff said that there I didn't recall any negative reviews of judges. I can think of one in Bethel, one in Anchorage area, one in the Kenai Peninsula in recent years. But the fundamental question, I guess, I have about this approach is that it's a different way of appointing judges to some of our courts than to other of our courts. And I guess the question to the sponsor is why a bifurcated system? Why do it two different ways? If it needs fixing, why not take on the whole problem?
I'm sure. Through the chair, Senator Keel, thank you. Good question. And I would in part respond to what happened with SJR3, where we tried to look at the ability to do that that might help across the board. However, the effort was shut down, and I would remind the committee that at the time, when, again, we're told it's not politicized, we had a former Supreme Court Chief Justice sitting at the back of the room heckling while we had the committee, and you can go back and watch it if you want to see it. So, again, I would say that don't tell me it's not political. It absolutely is, and they do get involved. So finding that that is in the Constitution and crystal clear, that is a very heavy lift to get a constitutional amendment and get the votes required, a tough thing to do. And while that would be something that I would entertain trying to get to, if there is a method for the legislature to take back some of its constitutional authority, and I say take back is not the right word, to exercise its constitutional authority to appoint those lower courts, I think it's something that we as a body should attempt to do. And at this point, it's going to be very difficult when you say bifurcate, because it is, because of how it is set up in the Constitution and what authority was granted previously for that and what authority is granted to us as the legislature. And wanting to solve at least part of the problem is why we ended up with a statute. Still have the SJR filed to talk about this constitutionally. So I agree with you. I would like to do both, but I'm not naive. I know the chance of me being able to achieve that is probably pretty slim in the body. So we want to do as much movement as we can on having the representatives of the people have input to the process and not simply a trade organization. And so that's kind of why we ended up here. I would like to defer in case I'm missing a significant point from Mr. Rogan.
Mr. Rogan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, you know, constitutional fathers or founders, I guess we'll not use a gender reference in the description, were very clear in setting up how the Superior Court and justices are appointed. They also gave a lot of discretion to the future legislature as things change to be able to set up other jurisdictions. That's completely within the legislature's authority because they anticipated as the state grows, things change. We're going to need to change things to adapt. Yes, it's a bifurcated system because there are constitutional sideboards on what the Constitution prescribes. But there's clearly the authority and the constitutional intent to allow us to set the different jurisdictions up the way we see fit. And frankly, I see it as a balance. You know, if I'm a litigant and I have, part of the problem is that the appellate judges are mostly prescribed by statute at this time. They mostly deal with criminal cases and some child cases. We're considering an amendment to expand that to include civil cases. But if I'm a civil litigant, for example, and assuming that appellate courts can do civil cases, currently I get to go before one judge, and that judge gives me either thumbs up or thumbs down in my case. And I can appeal to the Supreme Court, but all I can appeal is whether or not the judge erred in reading the statutes or violated my constitutional rights. In the meantime, if I find out that there's some information, for example, election information, you have an election case, you take it to the judge, they say, oh, no, sorry, you don't have a case. by the time you get to the Supreme Court, and there's a very short window in those election cases, by the time you get to the Supreme Court, between the time the judge ruled and you go to the Supreme Court, there's additional information that you find. You can't argue that information unless you brought it up in the original trial. You can only argue whether or not the judge erred interpreting the statute or the Constitution. So if you have an appellate system that also includes civil, for example, then you can go get that opinion. You know, you can get a second opinion by three judges, and that's the way the federal court's set up. You know, I've spent a lot of time in federal court with DNR, and we would go to before the district court judge. And if we wanted to appeal, we could go to there's two levels of appellate court in federal court. There's a three judge appellate court in the circuit court, and then there's the en bloc, the whole circuit court, or an 11-judge panel in the Ninth Circuit. I think there's more judges than that, but they do up to 11 en bloc. So you've got two levels of appellate courts before you go to the Supreme Court. In Alaska, we don't have that. We have you get before one judge, and then if you don't get your way in front of that one judge, you can go to the Supreme Court. Our Supreme Court can't deny a cert, so they will hear a case no matter what. But it would, I think it behooves us to consider creating a circuit breaker, and a circuit breaker that has maybe a different way of getting there, with a little bit more accountable to the people. That maybe and in this bill, we're also asking that the Judicial Council to evaluate whether or not a judge will consider strict interpretation of statutes, regulations, and the Constitution. So I think it's just a more balanced approach.
Madam Chair, I'd like to request an at-ease. As a majority member, I need to speak to the bill sponsor, not related at all to the bill.
Okay, yeah, and then we're gonna have to move on because I've got two more speakers online right now, okay? Okay, we took a brief at ease. I'm going to let Senator Keel. I think you had one final wrap up, and then Senator Hughes, and then we need to move on to the two invited. So if we could wrap up within 5 minutes, that would be great. Okay, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a very brief comment, and then I do have a follow up question. But I have to take just a second. I was in the hearing on SJR3. Madam Chair, and I take tremendous exception at the description of the former Chief Justice. He and I both laughed at the same joke. A joke was made. Nobody heckled anybody in that hearing. And I would refer anyone on issues of decorum to the chair of the Judiciary Committee at that time, who saw no need to enforce decorum, and who certainly would have had there been an issue. Thank you for that indulgence, Madam Chair. On the follow-up question has to do with that point on the interpretation of statutes and regulations. I don't fully understand the two terms that are used in the bill, a strict constitutional interpretation and adhering to legislative intent. My sense, and I don't have the law degree, Madam Chair, is that those tend to be judicial philosophies in conflict. And so if I could ask the sponsor his intent in requiring strict adherence to both of those.
And just 1 minute. I'd just like to make a real quick comment before Senator Schauer makes a comment. None of our bills are supposed to be in conflict with the Constitution, so I see no problem with it, but I don't want to answer for the sponsor. So with that, Vice Chairman Schauer.
Madam Chair, thank you. Can I also respond to that comment just briefly, because I do think I want
Please.
To keep the record correct. That's subject to interpretation from that meeting. I can tell through the chair to Senator Keel that it was so disruptive that you can watch me on the tape, and several times I had to turn around and look at them because of the comments that were made. And I actually told the Judiciary Chair at the time to watch that, which she did. And the next day, the next committee hearing, you may remember that she informed him that he would not take that kind of behavior in his courtroom, and he certainly should not have spoken and gotten to that point in her room, they should respect the chamber. So I remember it a little differently, and that's fine. I just want the record to be reflected very clearly that that's how that process played out, to the point that I actually had to tell the chair to ask her to make sure that that kind of behavior did not happen. So for what it's worth, on both sides, and I understand that. Regarding your question, I would like to defer to Mr. Ogan because of the research side of it, but I think it would be more illuminating than me trying to answer that question, also not being a lawyer.
Mr. Ogan, if you can do it in 1 minute or less, that would be terrific, because we have speakers online.
Okay, I believe the question was why the strict interpretation language. You know, we've had some recent cases, for example, the two signatures on ballots that basically defied the legislative intent and the statute. And so that's just one example. And I think it's always, you know, I hope most judges do that, but we just want to make sure that, you know, we have the authority to set the criteria of how they evaluate judges. Right now, the legislature gives no direction at all that I'm aware of to judicial counsel, and we have someone to testify. They may have a different opinion. I'd love to hear it if they do. Thank you.
I'm sure I owe him a better answer. We will get it. We're just time limited right now to go through.
Okay, thank you. And with that, we're going to go ahead and move on to the next section. And this will be, we will continue this on Friday, and I'm sure this is going to be debated. So anyway, thank you for the question. I really appreciate it. And with that, we're going to take a very brief at ease right now. And I'm going to make a quick comment about the masks. I'm asking people, you wear them if you don't, you know, if you want to. But if you want to give each other the 6 feet, that's fine. You know, we're trying to respect the 6 feet rule. But if you want to wear them, you certainly are able to wear them. This is exactly what they did in the press conference the other day. So anyway, we're just following the example that was set. But with that, we're going to go ahead and make sure that our audio visual is working. So I'm going to just check with my staff. Kelly Toth, is everything ready to go? You can sit wherever you want. If you want to stay down there, you're fine. I don't care. Or you can come back in.
Are we continuing on SB14 with comments, or are we moving to the next?
We're moving to the next at this point in time. Okay, thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. We're going to do a quick sound check to make sure that before I introduce our next speaker, I want to make sure that we can hear her loud and clear. We're going to take an at ease. Ms. Campbell, can you hear us?
I can hear you. I didn't know what at ease meant, so I'm not sure.
Okay.
It means a whole different thing to me from military background than what you guys are doing, I think. So, but can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. I'm going to go ahead. That showed that we were recording. Okay, we gaveled back in. I thought we'd already gaveled back in. Okay, so with that, I want to move on to the next. Last week, we were supposed to be talking about the impacts of the elderly and the youth and the mandates that the Attorney General approved, and the extended disaster declaration, which is on very shaky legal grounds. So we've had to readjust things because of the Attorney General and the situations with him. And ask you to step in. I will tell you, these are two people. Sarah Price is from Eagle River, and she will be next. She's a student there that's been actively advocating for the schools to be open. But first of all, I want the honor and privilege of introducing Ms. Campbell. Ms. Campbell has taken 4 active calls to duty, and I tell you, your military stories are just remarkable. Thank you for stepping up and doing such a phenomenal job defending freedom for this country. You've also been working with the Anchorage School District almost 20 years. She teaches AP U.S. Government, AP U.S. History, she teaches the Holocaust, World History. She's a professor. I believe you have 3 degrees. She's a professor at UAA. Unfortunately, she's not doing that right now because of the pandemic, and she's in the U.S. Army Reserves. And I can tell you, I subbed for many years, and she was the model of excellence for teacher for me. She taught me how to be a very, very effective substitute teacher, even long term. And you're just an exemplary model of an excellent educator. And both my kids thrived under you, and almost all my friends did. So I just, with the highest of regards, Ms. Campbell, what I've asked you to speak on is the impacts on education with the teachers due to the ongoing disaster declarations. And if you could just please educate us on what's going on in education.
Okay, thank you for this opportunity. Just to clarify, I'm retired from the reserves at this point. I spent 30 years, but I'm done. So happy not to have to jump out of the classroom if for any more recalls to active duty. So that's very helpful. But thank you for the opportunity to do this today. As Senator Reinbold said, I just feel like I'm testifying on the impact of the series of emergency executive actions that have had from my foxhole, in the classroom as a teacher of regular students. All of my data, of course, is anecdotal. I'm not going to get up here and give you national stats or anything like that, but I can tell you what it is like for me and for my students these past 8.5 months of not getting to teach in a physical environment of which both sides of us have been trained for all of our lives. And so I feel like these comments are kind of worthy of just your note for your background, something you wouldn't normally get to see. I have five areas of concern that I'd like to talk about briefly, and I'm going to set my timer because I can definitely talk, and I want to make sure I stay within your parameters because I know you have a lot of business to get to. So the first, of course, is academic development. I've often during the 4 years of high school, I've often compared students to dogs' lives. They do so much advancement, each from a freshman to a sophomore to a junior to a senior. It's almost like the 7 years when you compare to a dog's life. There's so much advancement. And so while missing out on 8.5 months might not seem that traumatic, it's actually significant in the academic growth of a high school student. So while missing out, for example, for 8.5 months of work at home and then having to return, that loss might be negligible. However, high school students, this is immeasurable. Not only will they have to make up time learning simply edited out because of the scheduling that we have to live on Zoom, they will simply have lost huge chunks of learning due to nearly a year of time with no scope and sequence. During fourth quarter last year, for example, when we were foisted upon this really quickly, the district, and to their credit, they were trying to scramble. For regular classes, we were given canned classes that had nothing to do with where we were supposed to be in the curriculum. Just to give you an example, I was ready to start World War I after spring break, and we were given this social, emotional stuff to teach for the rest of the quarter. So my children in world history got no 20th century history. My AP kids were the only ones I was allowed to hang on to, as some was the curriculum, but we had to move at such an incredible warp speed to get ready for the AP test that it was incredibly difficult. So kids in regular history classes across Anchorage got no 20th century history, because if you're on world history, American history, any of that, you're ready to go into the 20th century. So none of that was taught. Kids in the entire district of 48,000 kids, all the high school students got no 20th century history. And then here we roll into a summer of a lot of protests and other things. They had no civil rights history. They had no understanding probably of any of the stuff, the history that happened there. So that was lost. And then we come into this school year and we get handed this 4 9-week where we're teaching three classes at a time, four Zooms a week at 90 minutes. If you do the math on that, that is a loss of 6 weeks of face-to-face contact time over a semester. And so now we're faced with two things. Not only am I having three things. Put on my class online, which none of my classes were meant to be done that way. So that was hours and hours of extra work, which I'm not here to talk about me, but I had to prepare all of that in very short time. And then we are excising from the curriculum 6 weeks of contact time. And now we are also doing it all in 8.5 weeks. So we have 2 8.5 weeks time frames that are supposed to be the whole school year of 36 weeks. And we have lost 6.5 weeks contact time. And we have lost an entire quarter's worth of history in the scope and sequence for the next year. So the kids are scrambling with all of this, of course, and that's just the content that was lost, okay? So I have to account for all that. There's really no time for makeup or to remediate or any of that. And then, of course, we're online. And so I've always had spent a lot of time after school and at lunchtime helping kids who get overwhelmed or they need extra help. They need that one-on-one. And all of that is gone. There's no one-on-one time. I have forwarded my I forwarded my classroom phone to my cell phone. And so effectively all my students have my cell phone number. And that is one thing I have done to try to be there for them. And so they literally can call me at any time to try to get help immediately, as well as email and other standard ways. But I've tried to reach out to them because they're just so alone out there. They're very, very much alone. Now, so that's the academic piece. The other problem with Zoom that we've been dealing with for these last 8.5 months is the amount of cheating that goes on. It is, I feel very helpless in dealing with this, the amount of cheating. Students are free to Google search every test that I try to give them. I'm not a tech person, so it's very difficult for me to redevelop all of my exams and classes. To go from pen to paper and putting all of this online. The kids, they're faster than me at the workarounds to get on a computer. And so they're losing skill sets because it's easy for them to just cheat. It's so easy, and it's hard for me to defeat that. And even though I morally try to reach out and say, hey, guys, one day we're going to go back to real life. I don't know when that is, but when we go back to real life, you're actually going to have to take a test without being able to Google search the answer. And this has been very difficult. About the only testing out there that's realistic is when I give an AP test online where there's a lockdown browser that prevents them from doing certain things. And I can put a time limit on it. But it's very, very difficult. And it's hugely time consuming to try to deal with this issue. Thirdly, the interpersonal skill loss. One of the things that I have my whole teaching career watched, particularly in the last decade, is the loss of interpersonal communication skills. And so therefore, in my classes, I spend a lot of time really pushing the kids where they have to work together in group projects, which, you know, sounds horrible, but actually it's something that universities are moving more and more to, and trying to get them, they have to actually get up and speak to people and talk to people. I have no cell phones in my classroom ever, that no devices, nothing. We are in a personal communication environment because these children are losing these skill sets. In the last 10 years, we've now put a cell phone, effectively a computer in their hand 24/7, and that's what they're relying on. And I have kids that literally text each other. They're three lockers away. And there's just no feeling that they need to actually speak. And so now what we're actually losing that interpersonal communication time. And so with the shutdowns, we've lost, of course, I'm also the athletic director at Eagle River High School. So I have that whole thing that I've been dealing with. So we've lost our proms. We've lost the dances. We've lost the we have barely athletic competitions that came back this week. And the kids hardly knew how to behave. They're scared. They're so terrified of having someone yell at them for their mask slipping in some way while they're running down a court playing basketball, sweating to death. So these children have lost their ability to interact, and they're regressed in many ways. In this way, there's no athletic banquets. There's no student government activities. When we come back to school, there's going to be an enormous loss. And it's not going to just, they're not like adults. They don't have that kind of coping mechanism, okay? So, and then fourthly, the safety of school is just gone, okay, for my young people. I can't tell you over the years how many kids I have talked one-on-one and have helped. And yes, I've had to call social services on many occasions because there's ugliness happening at home that is not a safe environment. But thankfully, we've had school people there in these children's lives to interject and on their behalf. And we see those signs and we know, and we can actually, you know, in many ways, I think, save lives. And I'm not getting to have any of that time with students. So I mean, I don't believe for a second that in 8.5 months that all of a sudden all of our domestic violence issues are solved, and all of a sudden kids don't need the safety of school or a school teacher who who's the one person they feel like they can talk to and maybe get some help in that arena. And it's been really very, very difficult. And so finally, the other thing is the screen time. So I am really alarmed at this in particular, because not only we put school screen time, because kids have already had the social screen time in their lives, you know, specifically in the last 10 years, it just escalated significantly. So now we're putting them on screen time for school, right? And the pandemic has created a terrible third situation of what I call escapist screen time, where we're all watching Netflix and such. And God help us, why not? Because we want to escape some of the stress of everyday life. But now, because of what we're doing with schools in the pandemic, we've increased screen time by about 60 to 70% for young people, thus even further hampering their ability as humans to be able to interact. And so finally, teaching is a human experience, not virtual. Never meant to be that way. I know we have been prioritizing health of older and more informed people in our nation, but we can't assume that our children's continuing loss of education is of less importance. High school kids are losing exponentially amounts of learning, life skills, and irreplaceable moments as we continue ceasing life during emergency mandates. In our current nation, currently in our nation of various mandates, teachers have one mandate, and that is to teach. Indefinitely, emergency orders keeping this from happening in school has had dire consequences that we'll be measuring for several years to come. Thank you for your time today, and I really, really appreciate you letting me come and speak a little bit from what it is inside of my classroom on these mandates. So, shutting down.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell, very, very much. I just want to reiterate some of the things that you said at a high level, and she's actually welcome to take a few questions if people would like to do that. But that the screen time has increased 60 to 70% with the children, that the high-risk children, there's not the teacher intervention, so we don't know really what's happening in those high-risk situations. Contact has been lost with interaction with the students, and you listed a whole bunch of them, and thank you. I forgot to mention your athletic director. You do a fantastic job there. Content has been lost as well. You described it very detailed, some of the content, and that's very alarming to me. I had two quick questions, and I want to see if anybody else has a question, but I wanted to say that I walk around that high school, and you are there. And I can tell you the parking lot's pretty much empty. So I have one question. How many teachers are actually showing up into the building? That'd be my first question. And so if you could just answer that one first, and then I'm going to see.
Okay. I've been into the building every single day since this year for sure. Last year when they locked up the building, I would go in. I have a master key, so I would go in and teach from there anyhow. I've been in every day except Wednesdays, because that's our asynchronous day where I just bury down and grade. And routinely while I'm there, I would see, before they started bringing back some of the failure kids, which they're trying to bring back in labs a little bit, the kids who failed, done nothing but fail. We would have maybe five teachers in any given day, maybe three, sometimes just me. And cause I'm the athletic director, I can get in and out, but almost never. I rarely have a conversation with anybody. But when we started, a couple of weeks ago, we had started bringing in kids to the labs who had failed almost all their classes so far since we've been online. And so now we have, I would say, maybe 8 or 9 teachers in the building every day. They're definitely doing most of their jobs. They're definitely taking advantage of the telework agreement that they got from the union and the district.
If you can take just a couple more questions, Sarah, if you can hang on, we're going to get to you in just a few minutes, okay? Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You may not remember, but you actually
taught our daughter. Remember.
In the late, toughest teacher she said she had, but also learned the most. So thanks for that. So I hear a lot of the issues of critical thinking, you know, smartphones making us really not smarter because we don't remember numbers, just all these things, cheating. You may have seen in the news recently a couple of the military academies had cheating scandals, et cetera. So
yes.
Not to tie those to this, my question to you would be this. I hear the problems, But from a teaching perspective, like we were told last week from the doctor from the Barrington Declaration about his answer, or at least some answers to how to do this, you protect the vulnerable, et cetera. Do you have within a minute or so something quickly where you can tell us what would you see with all these issues are some solutions that would help guide us in how we would make it better? Because we've got lots of problems, and this is terrible across the board, but how do we make it better? What can we do to help?
Are you asking about how to bring kids back into the building, or are you asking about how to make up the loss?
Well, I guess probably both, but more interested in moving forward. Are there things that, as from your perspective as teachers, that we can help do that will allow you to do what you need to do in around these issues we're having of the COVID scare, the shutdowns, those kinds of things? I mean, you go, hey, one, two, three, these things would really help us. We're looking for some solutions to help as opposed to just what the problems are, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, I think part one of the things that's going to be very difficult is if we're going to have a lot of grace when we come back together, and we're going to have to keep classroom sizes much smaller, I think, enable us to have more time with kids, to be able to give them more attention individually, because kids are going to have to, I mean, they're all over the place. I mean, depending on what their home situation is, we have some kids, AP kids, they can kind of go with the flow, but a lot of those kids have dropped out. I have the least amount of AP kids I've ever had. Many of them have dropped out because they can't handle the pace and without any teacher support, except for Zooms. And it's been, that part's been difficult. So in fixing this, the thing we need to do first is get back in school immediately. We should have done this. I mean, I can't believe we weren't in school. I really was shocked in August. I was more shocked at second quarter. And I couldn't believe that we weren't back in after Christmas break. And now we had a faculty meeting yesterday that just, it was depressing, because these teachers are like, the district has come down and said, we're going back to school after spring break no matter what. And all these roadblocks of why we can't do that. And I'm like, we need you to be in school, guys. We need to wait. It's like when you get into a car, you know you might die in a car accident. All of us know there's terrible we need to risk assess and just move forward, but we can't do anything about fixing anything or make a single plan until we're definitely back in the school and we know what we're dealing with as far as class sizes, and we can move forward. I mean, you know, teachers have a lot of options. I did not order these for my classroom, but teachers can order these, that plastic thing that I saw your tech lady sitting behind, they can put those up in the classrooms. There's a lot of options. Teachers have been given a lot of options about, you know, how to their safety level of doing this, but students need more time on target. And I wish we could go to school in the summer. I mean, to be honest, I really have lost so much. I wish we could extend the school year. No one's going to want to hear that. But if you want to hear the academic solution, that would be it.
Okay. And thank you. We're going to have one more question, and then I'm going to move to the next speaker, Senator Hughes.
Yeah, thank you for being here. It is, it really is grievous to hear the impacts on the students. One of the things, MATSU did not close its schools. They've been open all year. And we have heard stories of families from Anchorage coming out and securing a residence with an address so that they can enroll their students in the MATSU schools so they can have live instruction. And if there is a COVID incident in the school, then they transition to online for a couple of weeks for a quarantine period. And that transition back and forth has gone quite smoothly. They set their curriculum to be able to do that, and it's worked well. And I think what we're going to see is we're going to see some probably better academic achievement in that district compared to other districts that went totally virtual. So my question to you, as far as teaching staff, have you heard about teachers that would like to, would prefer working out in MATSU where we don't have the home rule situation that the Anchorage Assembly and Mayor and the school board seems to be subject to? And I guess I would ask too, the schools being closed in Anchorage is the Anchorage School District School Board's decision, not the Anchorage Assembly's decision. Is that correct?
It's the school board. I know that all the school board members except one had supported this. Let me just go back, and you go back to your in order of what I heard your questions. So the answer, I'm very connected with teachers in the MATSU, and I totally agree with you. It is working. When we go back, we are planning on keeping the Canvas shells going so that if we have a positive, we can actually kind of flow back and forth. We have to be out for a few days. If I had known, if you asked about teachers that I know of, if I had known after what I went through fourth quarter last year that we were going to be shut down, I would have been one of those teachers that would have applied in MATSU to work face-to-face. I would never in a million years ever sign up to teach, to do online instruction ever again, if I can help it. I have talked to they're not the majority, but I have talked to teachers that want back face-to-face really badly, very badly, and would do in whatever it takes. But there are pretty significant holdouts with the union, significant. A lot of power out there on that side.
Thank you.
Okay. So with that, Ms. Campbell, I want to say thank you. And I believe what you are in line with is the Great Barrington Declaration, which was a focused protection of the most vulnerable, typically the elderly amongst us. They are huge advocates of having all the children. They think that schools have never been shut down. We had a professor that spoke. He was from Sweden, and the schools never closed there. He said the teachers over 60 should be the ones that have special accommodation and mitigation, but pretty much everybody else, you know, unless they're super high risk for something, should be teaching. You have one mandate, and that is to teach. And one of my biggest concerns is that the students are falling, so many, and I have never talked to so many parents and some of the most amazing parents and the struggles that they are having, and every single time I am in my district, I hear about it, and I'm very, very frustrated by what's going on. And it was the Attorney General that approved these disasters and the disaster mandates, and so therefore I believe judiciary is a great. But I'm going to transition and just do a quick. We have a special person in the room, and I just really wanted to ask you if you would be a resource for him. But we have a new education chair, and we're very, very excited to have Senator Roger Holland. And I want to ask you, Ms. Campbell, if you would be a resource for his committee. I didn't want to in any way steal any of your thunder with education, but this is a huge impact. And he is a senior chief Coast Guard, officially retired this past Monday, but he's the bosun mate senior chief of the Coast Guard, and it's a super big honor to have him part of the Senate now. And I'm going to personally ask you if you wouldn't mind being an advocate and if he chooses to have you before his committee, I would ask him if Senator Holland, if you would be interested. I will be happy to get you all her contact information. And Ms. Campbell, would you be agreeable to that?
Oh, sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And so we're going to transition now to a wonderful Eagle River High School student that is actually one of Ms. Campbell's students as well.
Yes.
Yes, she's a rising star, I will tell you that. I have spoken before the school board with her. We've been pleading for the schools to be open. And, Sarah, I can't say enough positive things about you, except you're a woman that I'm going to be following, and I think you're going to go extremely high places. And with that, I want to also say she's doing a lot of mask research for my office. She asked how she could help. And the CDC, I call it the, what they posted on their research is the hairdresser research, which I cannot believe that all of us are doing these because of the hairdresser research primarily on the CDC. But I have not been impressed with the CDC's constant stance on changing of masks. And I personally believe they're a false sense of security for some. Those that choose to wear them, I think they absolutely positively should. But I think the science needs to be very, very sound with them, and I certainly haven't seen a lot of that, but we're digging deep in our office in regards to that and the effects and the impacts. Is this really social distancing? To me, the masks are more social distancing, and the physical distance is actually, the 6 feet physical space between them. I divert, though. But anyway, Sarah will be back at some point to talk about research and the impacts of masks and students as well. But with that, Sarah Price, please put yourself on the record and present your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Senator. And can you guys hear me clear? Okay. Good afternoon, honorable senators. My name is Sarah Price, and I'm a junior from Eagle River High School. I'm here today because my education and the safety of Alaska's children has been made into a political game. This committee's job is to uphold our laws and fulfill your oath of office to defend not only our national constitution, but our state one as well. In Article 7, Section 1 of Alaska's constitution, it defines the legislature's responsibility to, by general law, establish and maintain a system of public schools open to all children of the state. Over the last 10 months, school, which was supposed to serve as every child's safe haven and a source of equal opportunity, has diminished into a virtual system in which mental health issues, discrimination, and neglect are seen as the new normal. When local districts and school boards fail this responsibility, the duty to protect our children falls on you. In March of 2020, schools everywhere were closed because we truly did not know what this virus would bring. But now we do know, and we know that schools are safe. The CDC and WHO have recommended since the summer that if possible, communities should send their students back without delay as, quote, the harms attributed to closed schools on social, emotional, and behavior, economic well-being, and academic achievement in children in both short-term and long-term are well-known and significant. From New York to Texas and Washington to Florida, children have been back in school for months. So why not all of Alaska? In the Anchorage School District, the largest district in the state, they have fallen back on every back-to-school plan they have made. In the fall, they told the community this was for our safety, but upon inquiry of top administrators, I was informed that it was the teacher unions who would not let them reopen. Despite all that has changed in our community, the same is true today, and they have exploited the citizens' concerns of COVID to keep our doors shut. However, the reality of children with COVID in Alaska is that the ages of 0 to 19 make up 27.5% of the population, yet only 18.5% of all cases, 1.6% of hospitalizations, and 0% of deaths. Through closing schools, they are not saving lives. They are ruining tens of thousands. It is well known and thoroughly analyzed that virtual school is not an efficient method of education. In the Anchorage School District, failure rates and absenteeism has doubled in every grade, while in the groups of economically disadvantaged, minorities, and disabled students, these numbers are even higher. Even before COVID, high school students in my district were 64% and 73% below proficient in language arts and mathematics. Nationally, Alaska falls 46th in mathematics, 49th in language arts, and 50th overall. There is no 51st place. We cannot afford this kind of academic decline. And while these grades alone may shock you, I can tell you that far more students can no longer find the motivation to do their work or see a purpose in their lives. The real safety hazard caused by failed administrative leadership is keeping adolescents in despondent conditions where depression is catalyzed and at-home abuse goes unseen. We live in a state where suicide is the second leading cause of adolescent death, and abuse is far too common. As a result of school closure, both these have increased, except you cannot tell through a Zoom camera whether someone is suffering, and many are. Myself and other students have witnessed a wave of depression and suicidal thoughts spread through our community. I could sit here and tell you the tragic stories of students in my community getting on medication and going to therapy instead of school, friends who must constantly convince each other it will get better, and those who we could not save and took their own lives. But we do not have enough time to talk about all that. Knowing for several months what children are enduring alone, only in this last week did my district allow K through second back. They stated that students do not learn and they need socialization. However, for the other 32,000 students, they have deemed these conditions acceptable. The legislature fulfilled their constitutional duties when they created Alaska Statute 14.03.010. However, if superintendents are allowed to abuse Alaska Statute 14.03.030 to keep our schools closed in the interest of teacher unions, and if school board members do not have to fulfill their oaths of office as designated in Alaska Statute 14.12.090, then your efforts are nullified. It is up to you to make sure these laws are followed and act accordingly when they are violated. As representatives of the people, you must come together and stand up to protect our most valuable assets, our children. Teacher unions, politics, and personal agendas must be put aside, and we must come together as Alaskans to ensure that every child has a safe place and the opportunity to obtain an education regardless of their zip code or age. Most students are too young or too exhausted to stand up for themselves. So will you stand up for those who do not yet have a voice in our community? Thank you.
Wow. Wow. Thank you so much, Sarah. Extremely impressive. And with that, are you comfortable taking a few questions from some senators?
Of course.
Okay, thank you. We will start with Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sarah, I got to tell you, in the last year, I've heard a lot, you know, presidents, congresspeople, leaders, military, doctors, news people, entertainers, you name it, across the board. And I am not sure that I have heard a better, passionate, statistic-filled plea and speech about the impacts to our young generation than I just heard in the last 5 minutes. You are indeed a force to be reckoned with, and perhaps you should be in charge here. It's a little bit of a joke. However, I make a little bit light of it because there's no doubt that what you're talking about are things we've heard as well. Domestic violence, addictions, suicide, depression, all the things that are impacting young folks. Thank you for taking the time to research it and to reach out. I don't have so much as a question, Madam Chair, as to say I hope you will continue to advocate for this, because as I asked your teacher, which ironically said my daughter had the same teacher, we know many of the problems now. And as you illuminated, we also know much more about this virus and things we can do with vulnerable populations. We thought it was the zombie apocalypse last March and we hit the panic button, and that was fair. I don't think we need to do that now. I continue to ask the questions of you and others, is knowing the problems is important to help guide us to the best solutions. But I would ask that same thing for you. You help with what are the solutions, what will work to get us to where we need to be for the younger generation as well, because I think, honestly, one of the most impressive things about this is that we don't necessarily know what's happening to you. We hear it from the government side. We hear it from all kinds of industry, you know, those kinds of things, but not necessarily from the kids telling us what's happening to you and how we can make it better. So I would only ask one thing, and you don't have to answer it as a question now, is help us, help guide us from your generation to the things you need. And I think you've mostly answered that, but don't stop doing it, because we need to hear from you what we need to do, because we don't necessarily know and we don't understand the next generation and how you text and communicate. So please, thank you for the indulgence, Madam Chair. It was fantastic. I wasn't kidding. That's probably one of the best ones I've heard in a year. But I would ask that her and others continue to help us find the solutions to the problem to make it better. Thank you.
And thank you, Vice Chair Schauer. And with that, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Price, thank you for your presentation. I have a daughter who is a high school junior, and I was impressed. I saw the two of you can both spit some fire, let me tell you what. I was also impressed. I just have to say, the biostatistician who came to this committee with the Great Barrington Declaration brought us exactly zero statistics, exactly zero plans, zero answers when he spun his Great Barrington fantasy. You brought statistics, statutes, and constitutional citations. So, you know, A-plus work. So here comes a hard question, right? Because you knew there'd be one at some point talking to legislators. Our Constitution, also in Article 7, requires the legislature to provide for the public health and the public welfare. And we know that in countries where they've kept the schools open, or open and closed them, like Sweden, like the UK, even where they have universal health care in both those countries, students have brought the virus home to grandparents, to parents and aunts and uncles who are cancer survivors, obviously with no intention. But there have been terrible consequences, right? Family members have died. So without ever trying to minimize the things you described, how should the legislature balance the two needs, the need to provide for the public health and welfare of vulnerable Alaskans with the quite legitimate social and educational needs of our young people? It's sort of, I see it as a choice of, you know, you've got all bad choices. How do we strike that balance?
Yes, sir. So as you said, risk analysis is really important right now. You have to balance the risks and the benefits of every situation. And so in this one, while my heart does go out to those who are vulnerable, what we are asking for is options, a choice. We're not forcing anyone who does not want to go back to go back. Those who are not healthy, those who are elderly, or those who are actually at risk are not going to be forced to go back, nor would anyone ask that of them. However, for the large majority of our population who recover from COVID, who don't even show symptoms from COVID, which does include all of our children, they should have that option to go back to school, because the harms of virtual school and keeping us out have always outweighed and are beginning to far outweigh any risk of returning and spreading COVID. And I also, you did say that students are bringing COVID home, but through many studies, they've actually found that it's not students bringing COVID home from schools, because schools are very well mitigated. They have found that students are bringing COVID from home and then coming back from school, and they're mistaking those from coming from school, but they're not coming from school, they're coming from home. They are largely spread in their homes. But I also will say that if you are worried for them bringing it home to their elderly people or someone they may not want to risk of COVID, in our district, 80% of families have consistently chosen to return. They've made that choice for their family. They've looked at all the different risks and they looked at the benefits, and they made that choice for their own health and their own family. And so they're putting that risk on the line. And so I would say that definitely balancing the risks and the benefits of this scenario are very key, because you're having more kids die of suicide than of COVID, and that needs to be what we worry about.
And Sarah, I'm going to have one more question, and I have to do closing comments, so this has to be super quick, okay? So if you can tighten it up real quick, Senator Hughes.
Okay. Well, as Senator Keel gave you an A-plus on your speech, I'm going to give you an A-plus on that response, because if there were a vulnerable person at home, every family has a choice, and our districts have options with public and private correspondence and homeschool. So I think that situation takes care of itself. My question to you, Sarah, is have you spoken before the Anchorage Assembly and the Anchorage School Board, because the decision to keep the Anchorage School District closed falls in their hands, and you have a powerful presentation, and if you haven't spoken before them, I encourage you to do so.
Yes, ma'am. So I have spoken in front of both of those groups. I've been speaking to the school board for the last 5 months. I've had private phone calls. I've talked with them in person. And I will say that there are one or two members that are very passionate about us returning. And then there are others who are not. And they have told me that is for the safety of our community. And when they said that, it was in November and December, where it was the peak of our COVID cases. So understandably, some of our hospitals were getting to their capacity and everything. But every time before that, they were not. And then after having that conversation with them, I told them at one of the last school board meetings, the cases had dropped 50%. The hospitalizations had dropped 50%. Both of those right now are extremely low. They're as low as they were in the fall. And any other state would be so glad that they had the numbers and COVID circumstances that we did, because other states don't have a grasp on their numbers. Other states don't have a grasp on their vaccination and tracking it. We do. And so for them to keep us out of school is a choice. It's not for the health or well-being of our community. Because if it was for the health or well-being of our community, they would have opened it, knowing how many children are suffering right now. And I have talked to both those entities, but from inside sources on the school board, they have told me that the ones who are keeping it closed is because of the teacher unions. They will not tell the public. And that is one of the most sickening things about this, is they're lying to the public. They're turning people's legitimate fears of COVID. It is something to be concerned about, but they're using that to make them keep our schools closed and support it. When everyone on that board and all of the people in the administration know it's because the teacher unions and because teachers don't want to work. But that's no longer for the public and safety and well-being, which is what the Alaska statutes allows a superintendent to close a school for. That becomes a teacher strike, something they are not permitted to just close school for. And so it's hard to find this information out, because there's corruption right now and they're utilizing our lives and education for this. But if you call the right people and you do enough investigation, you're going to find out that what's best for our community, for our children, and for future generations is to send us back to school and do it as soon as possible and stop politicizing children's lives and futures.
Wow. Sarah, it's even hard to speak after you. Like I said, you're a rising star. You're carrying a big burden inside, like many of us are when I go back to my community. you know, there's so many people that I'm carrying a burden for, and that's why I'm fighting these disaster declarations and these mandates, and I will be a no vote on Senate Bill 56 because I can't go back and continue to see the suffering, the economic suffering, the suffering of the students, the suffering of our military, the parents that are trying to educate to the best of their ability, all the kids that are falling through this, let alone the suicide. We even had one in my neighborhood. It was a horrible night. I watched all the ambulances go through. It was a terrifying night for me personally. So I'm gonna fight these disaster declarations. I think that it's actually caused a catastrophe, and it's completely unacceptable, and someone will bear responsibility. We will bring those accountable, you know, that have caused this, and it's going to be clear someday, but we're going to get to the bottom of that, and this committee is going to be one of the committees that is doing that. So I just want to say that I'm going to put thank you. You will be coming back to before our committee at a later date, and I've also invited her down to you know, I got to go through some approvals, but I've also invited her down to Juneau so we can have her in person next time. In regards to, I want to do a quick shout out for Matt Sue. Congratulations, Matt Sue, for keeping the schools open and having no mask policies. And I can't wait till research is done to the Matt Sue versus Anchorage and the suffering that's gone on in our youth. And I have some research that I'm going to bring from a couple other states that have done counties with a bunch of lockdowns and others that have not. And it's almost negligible, the differences, but the collateral damage is huge. So I'm going to do a huge plug for Eagle Exit right now because I'm really tired of being, you know, under the claws of Anchorage School District and the Anchorage Assembly that do not represent Eagle River. We, like you said, about 80% of them have wanted to get the schools open, and I can tell you a lot of them do not like the masks as well. But anyway, I want to just do a point of clarification that the Great Barrington Declaration did talk about focus protections. You do not sacrifice the youth and the youth of education and our freedoms and our Constitution at the sake of the vulnerable. You have focus protection of them. And he did have the Sweden schools. Viruses have always been around. They always will be. They come from the home back to the school and back. That's happened. There's always been deaths, you know, in regards to do that. But anyway, I just wanted to say that he is a huge advocate, as you have been, and I have been there with the Anchorage School District with you, and you did a great job there. I just wanted to say it's not fair, the collateral damage that is happening with these extended disaster declarations. It's been almost a year now. It's the most painful thing I've ever seen in my entire life, watching the collateral damage from these. So with that, Sarah, we look forward to, and I think I can speak on behalf of everybody here, thank you from the bottom of our hearts, and also Ms. Campbell for the great things you've done in students. I can tell you, you have made super status of so many children, and both of you, it was a super big honor to have you today, so thank you very, very much. And with that, we ran a little bit late, we will be meeting back here. We will be doing a continuation, potentially, of Senate Bill 14. You know, if we can work out some of the details, hopefully Scott will be back here, you know, to deal with that. And also we will be doing some government appointees for the governor here on Friday. So we're going to gavel out at 3:05, and we will be back in this room at 1:30 Friday, February 5th. Have a great afternoon. Bye-bye.